Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Welcome back to the Sex RX Show with Michaela. Tonight's show is called Opening Up Pandora's Box on Alternative Sexuality, Identity, Orientation, and More. We're going to attempt to take the lid off of Pandora's Box. And I say attempt because anytime one wants to delve into the realm of sexuality, it is never a shallow swim, so to speak. So joining me tonight is Aisha Bailey to help listeners explore some of that box and gain insight. Ms. Bailey is a PhD candidate in clinical sexology. She's a board-certified sex therapist, board-certified transgender care therapist, a licensed mental health counselor, sexuality educator, advocate, and speaker working in private practice. She specializes with the LGB and transgender, intersex, and alternative sexuality communities, and she's focusing on providing affirming psychotherapy, utilizing a multitude of evidence-based approaches for those with gender and sexual variant concerns. These include coming out issues, gender and sexual identity orientation concerns, complicated relationship dynamics, polyamory, and consensual non-monogamy challenges and questions, monogamy challenges, fetishes, kinky practices, sex work challenges, sex addiction, intimacy concerns, lack of desire, orgasm concerns, MSM issues, race, cultural issues relating to the LGBT and kink community, also military trauma issues, past and present sexual trauma, and infidelity and cheating. Aisha is the owner and founder of the Bailey House of Wellness that focuses on providing assistance, including reduced cost of services to eligible individuals for the LGB, transgender, intersex, and alternative sexuality and MSM community. So with that, Ms. Aisha, welcome on tonight.
Thank you. Wow, Michaela, you got me sounding like I'm just busy as I don't know what. Oh, my goodness.
Well, you know what? I mean, just reading this off, you're welcome. I'm just reading off. I mean, I'm pretty sure this doesn't even cover everything else you touch, but, I mean, it gives a hint of the various things that you do work on with people, and I definitely think it is something that needs to be talked about, and so I'm so glad to have you on tonight. You know, and speaking of which, you know, let's just start off, first of all, by asking you, how did you get into the field? What made you choose this field?
Oh, where do I start? I think with anything, I would have to go back to my childhood. I grew up in a very sex-positive family, starting with my dad and my brother, who was very open with the women in their family, just teaching us and guiding us and making us feel very positive about our bodies. Also, I mean, the elders in my family, from my great aunt to my great grandmothers to my mom, I mean, it was just a taboo living in our community, but being in a household that promoted, like, sex positivity. So I first started out, like, going pre-med. I wanted to do OBGYN, and then, you know, something about that wasn't, for me, like, living my truth. So what I decided to do was, can you hear me okay?
I do.
Okay, so what I decided to do was just explore, like, other avenues and stuff like that for, like, relationships and sex. And as I started school, I knew sex therapy was the way to go for me. So that's how I got into the field, in a nutshell.
Okay, I love that. I mean, you don't really hear that from a lot of people. Well, I mean, no, not many people talk to anybody except for the close people. But, I mean, you don't, the usual, I guess, you know, in American society anyways, is I don't think a lot of us had that kind of upbringing. So I think it's kind of cool that your family was open to that and taught you. So, I mean, besides being sex positive, were they also open? I mean, I don't even know how it was back then if they came out with a lot of all the stuff that you're dealing with now. I mean, did your family discuss, like, people being bisexual or anything like that, and how did that go?
No, not at all. I mean, in the Black community, it was, if you, explored or displayed anything that they thought wasn't normal, you were a freak. You know, you were a freak or you were a hoe. And even though my family was sex positive, there were still some, you know, stereotypes and discrimination or views about, you know, lesbian, gays, and bisexual. But even in our family, I mean, we have transgender identified people. We have lesbian and gays, and they were accepted, but it was more of don't ask, don't tell. You know, we're not
right.
Coming out to the whole world. It's what happens in this house stays in this house, and that was it. So for me, it was for me to kind of get out there, and I still felt different. You know, I even felt different in a very sex-positive family. I felt different and I felt not normal. And I didn't have any friends who identified like I identified. And it was for me to kind of do my own work and figuring out, was I going to live a life for other people or was I going to do it for me? So.
Yes, that's a big question. I think that all of us face at some point or another. And I think the sooner than later that we start to figure that out, we start to become more whole. And I know it's a lifetime journey, but I mean, dang, some of us don't even get there. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, one of the things I wanted to say before we get forward with even more questions that I have for you tonight is, you know, some people asked, like, you know, when I went promoting for the show, you know, I got some feedback like, you know, why does this matter? Who cares? You know, this is something anybody could Google if they want to, or, you know, what happens behind closed doors is, and it's true, what happens behind closed doors is none of our business, but the fact of the matter is, obviously, there's a lot of prejudice out there for people that are not like ourselves, and what I've noticed with the younger generation, obviously, they've been raised differently, and so they're seeing different things. They're being guided, maybe not by their families or those that they should maybe be being guided by, but they're being guided by the media, they're being guided by their friends. So, I mean, I do think, yes, you can Google all you want, but I think sometimes hearing upfront, honest, frank, real stuff with people like you that are in the field, I think that can will resonate with some, and maybe not everybody, but some. So that's what I wanted to start off. And so the next question I really have for you, Ms. Aisha, is how is it working with non-traditional, in parentheses, or not as talked about outlier situations, for example, the LGB, the transgender, the alternative sexuality communities? What is that like for you?
Oh, I say it was a rewarding career, but it's also very difficult at times. And going back to what you just said, a lot of people wanted to know, oh, I can just Google information. A lot of what they're finding is based off of heteronormative ideals. And they don't go to the community. They're not going to the transgender community. They're not going to the alternative sexuality community and finding out what is it like to be them. So when they say, what does it matter? Let's take black trans women are being murdered at an astronomical rate. That's why it matters. We are talking about in 2017, we are looking at the LGBT community being in crisis over whether or not they're going to have rights to marry, rights to adopt, whether they're going to be able to live openly as who they are. You have people in the alternative sexuality communities who have lost their jobs, who have been outed to their families, lost their families, lost everything they own. They are significantly higher in the LGBT community, especially the trans community, for suicidal ideation or suicidal thoughts and suicidal attempts. So I will tell any of the listeners that's why it matters. These are not freaks of nature. These are not clowns. These are human beings. And we need to look out for our fellow human beings. So it does matter. Now back to your other question, I would say it's very rewarding. It's difficult at times. I consider myself an ally, both openly and privately in my home. When we say non-traditional, not talked about out loud, I always question why we don't talk about it when it's happening in our communities. We're talking about our sisters and brothers and uncles and aunts and coworkers, our CEOs, our managers, our employees. Why aren't we talking about it as if we're, like, talking about these aliens that just invaded the planet? It's just mind-boggling to me.
Right.
You know,
yes, you gave me goosebumps. I'm so glad you were able to point it out the way you did. That was very real and eloquent at the same time. And I think that's the bottom line that people need to get through our thick skulls, is that we are human beings, that we are brothers and sisters, and just to love one another. That's ultimately, I don't care what the hell you believe in, it's like that is supposedly the way, is just have love. And you can't be only halfway partial or kind of and exclude, you know. So I think that is so huge with that. So here's another question I have for you, because I know that probably a lot of people might have issues with this, whether they're younger, teens, or become an adult. How would you help? What kind of tips would you give to people that are trying to come out and let, you know, maybe their loved ones know? What would be your advice?
I would say first, figuring out who are you coming out to. Like who are you? Are you coming out to yourself? Are you owning your truth? This is who I am. Are you coming out to coworkers, family, friends, figuring out the coming out process. And sometimes, well, most times, coming out is lifelong. And again, I'm on my soapbox again. Heteronormative people don't have to come out. People don't come up to you and go, you know what? I'm a woman. I have a pussy, and I like men. And people are going to be looking at you like, what in the hell is going? Why are you telling me that? But yet and still, we expect LGBT people to actually come out to us to affirm who they are and who they are, not who they want to be, not who they're trying to be, but actually who they are. And I think the first step for anybody, any listener, any friend, any family member, if they had a problem with coming out, is figuring out the reasons why you are coming out.
Sorry, Ms. Aisha, I wanted to ask, are you saying that it's not necessary maybe for some that, like, it's a have to, it's an individual choice if they even feel like they even need to, and the why is behind it?
Yeah, I think it's an individual process. I feel like it's up to that person. It's individual based on whether or not they feel that they have to come out to anybody. You know, I've met some individuals along the way, both professionally and personally, that didn't feel that they had to validate who they were to anybody. And then I had others who really felt that the coming out process was a part of their own journey, and they needed to do it. So I say it's a very case-by-case basis. So first,
gotcha.
Figuring out the reasons of why they're coming out and who they come out to. I may come out to my family but not come out to my coworkers. Well, I may come out to my coworkers,
right,
but not come out to my children or whatever it is. So just figuring out the reasons why and why it's necessary for them to do it in the first place.
Gotcha. So there's so many different terms nowadays related to sexuality. Like, I don't even know all of them. But, like, you know, here's a term you use in your practice, intersex. What does that mean?
Intersex, back in the day, we used to call it hermaphrodite, you know, but intersex is just a broad, and they use a different terminology now, disorders of, they have another term, but I usually use intersex. So it's basically, it can be a medical, dealing with chromosomes, it can be, like, in a nutshell, to not make it so technical, I may have undescended testes, but I have a vagina, or my genitalia is not quote unquote normal. It doesn't look normal, or I may have a perfectly normal functioning genitalia, but I may have some other internal stuff that's going on that's causing me to maybe grow breasts, and I'm a male and I identify as male. So you have all these different scenarios and different medical diagnoses that's a part of the intersex community, but like I said, with anybody, they are still human too. So,
right. Okay, good. Thank you for answering that, because I'm like, I don't know what that is. Okay,
yeah.
Here's another one I want to talk about, because you know what? A lot of people don't talk about this, but I know that this is happening. I've had involvement myself at one point in time in my life, but I want to talk about swinging and how people that are in a monogamous relationship who might be interested in it, how could they make a healthy transition into that lifestyle, or at least test it out safely if that's what they think they might want to do?
With that, I would say do your research. And I'm not talking about going to Google and typing in swinging, because you will get all types of different stuff coming up. I'm talking about going out there, read books by Christopher Ryan, Sex and Dawn. Read The Ethical Slut by Dossie Easton and Janet Hardy. Opening Up by Tristan Tormino. Talk to a therapist, not only like someone like myself, a therapist. Go into the community, talk to other couples, but figure out how they dealt with things like jealousy, consensual practices, things of that nature. I think I tell everybody, do your research first. Know what you're getting into before you even attempt this type, quote-unquote, lifestyle.
Very true. I agree with that because, you know, I said on the last show it came up, but I think honestly with people that are trying to save their relationship with a lifestyle like this, it doesn't always work out that way, you know, so it has to be a
right.
mutual choice and loss of trust, you know, so I think that is very important. You know, the another thing that you deal with is fetishes and kinks. You know, I'm sure there's a bunch out there. What is like that, and how do you? Well, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it is case by case, but is there any fetishes or kinks that you've worked with that you know or do you consider all kinks and fetishes okay or normal?
What I say is, my kink is not your kink. What you're into doesn't mean that I have to not like it. I think the biggest thing for me is it consensual? Is it practiced in a very consensual way between two people, between two or more people? That's the biggest thing for me. So we're not talking about, like, rape. People think of kinky or fetishes or BDSM as rape or domestic violence or pedophilia. That's far from all these stereotypes that we have about what it's like to engage in a consensual power exchange dynamic. And for me, it would be, it doesn't matter what your kink is. If you're practicing it in a very consensual, ethical way, if you want to know about more about the kink, and I don't know, because, I mean, certain things I just don't know. I can't be an expert in everything, you know. So
right.
I would say I would explore that with you, the reasons why you like it. What is it about it that you like? Is it very obsessive and compulsive? Are you doing it in a way that it is leading to very compulsive and obsessive behaviors, i.e., where when we talk about certain things in addiction. So I would say there is not a person out there with any kink that I would probably turn away. Not at all.
Okay. See, and I think that's important to know. So, I mean, I guess what I'm getting from that, and if I need to be clarified, if you need to clarify, go ahead. It's not that any kink per se it could be considered abnormal. It's just a matter of it being consensual and that, you know, it's not like an obsession, you know, that, you know, takes over their life kind of thing or harming themselves or others, yeah?
Yeah, and when we talk about obsession, I mean, obsession, some people need certain things in order to get to whatever headspace or achieve orgasm or whatever it may be. But I think when we consider normal, we have to ask the question, what is normal? So even the word alternative lifestyle or alternative to what? Like, we've made it where having vanilla, monogamous sex is what is right. And anything else outside that box, outside that binary, is not right. You know what I mean? So even that word alternative, we have to look at alternative to what and what is normal. And if we look at it, a lot of us are not normal, quote unquote, by definition. So, but yet we still discriminate against people who are in these alternative lifestyles, thinking that, oh, they're not normal. They're doing something that's not normal, and we don't really do that. Well, you know, you need to think again. Think again.
I think that was a great question that you posed, you know, and it's important, again, you know, thinking for people. So that was a good point there. I have so many questions. I don't know how many we're going to get covered, but, I mean, again, I just want to address some of the highlights of your work because it's like, you know, this is important. You know, you work with sex workers, too. How do you help them, and what is your thoughts on the sex industry? Because, I mean, so many people have different says on all of that. Should it be legal? It's illegal. It's immoral. It's moral. What do you have to say, having experience working with people like them?
Yes, I would say for working with sex workers, same thing, very rewarding. Depends on what the person is coming in for. It can be, I'm suffering from depression that's not even related to my work. I just happen to be a sex worker, and I'm suffering from depression because I broke up with my boyfriend or something like that because he did not like the fact that I'm in, you know, I'm doing sex work of any kind. I would say the sex industry in itself, I would say it's still taboo. Sex in itself is still taboo in 2017. With the internet, with the social media, we still look at sex as this thing that it's not a part of us. It's just something we do. We don't look at ourselves as sexual beings. We don't look at it as normal. But the sex industry has been around, the industry or even sex work, you look at prostitution, is the oldest profession in our history. It's the oldest profession. And a lot of times we want to, I would say, criminalize those women, men. We want to look at them as shameful. They're sinful. They're not human. How could you sell your body? How could you be a porn star? How could you cam? How can you do all these things? And people don't really know the backstory. I may be a college student, and this may be the only way I'm paying for college. I may be your neighbor, your son, your daughter, and because of who I am, I was kicked out of my home, and this is the only work I can find. So a lot of times we shame sex workers instead of looking at it as, what is this person's story? Would it be better for them to be a doctor and lawyer? And by whose standards? You know, we have a lot of standards. Right. If you're not like a doctor or lawyer, you're not a therapist, if you don't have a high prestigious job, you're looked at as being less than. And sex workers are not less than.
See, that's yes, and that's huge too. And you know, I was just thinking about what you said. You know, well, they chose, this is the way they're going to pay for college, and you know, you could already hear a response. Well, they could have picked something else to do, and yes, they could have, but that was their choice. Whose business is it of ours? You know, but you know, in your experience, in your practice, have you worked with I don't know, is the percentage of sex workers that you've come across? Would you say that they are happy in their chosen profession, or do you seem to find people that were broken that got into this field, or is it a mixture?
I would say, that's a tough question. I would say maybe a mixture. I've found working with some who are happy and thriving, and this is what they do. It's not who they are, and that's my big term. This is what you do. It's not who you are. And then I found some who have some trauma history that they, you know, the only way they can pay for certain things, basic necessities, a roof over my head, clothes on my back, food in my stomach. I may have children. This is the only thing that I can find or that I'm eligible for that I can do in order just to survive. This is not to say that some may have suffered from addiction, unfortunately, but I think I kind of refrain from putting pathology on everybody because, like I said, every case is different, you know, and I am not here to judge anybody on anything they do. Now, if you come to me and you say, I want to get out of sex work and I want to do something different, then I can help you do that. But if you're saying, you know what, Aisha, this is what I do. I don't see myself getting out of this. It's good money. This is how I provide for my children. I'm not going to tell you to go back to school and be an attorney. I mean, I'm not here to tell you that.
I love that. Is that what you – would that be one of the things that would go under the affirming psychotherapy when you work with people, like at the positive I guess just I'm not going to even try to say what that is. Can you explain it? Because that seems like it would be a part of that.
Yes, affirming psychotherapy is something that, I mean, maybe the term has been out there, but I've always felt, I mean, I'm a Black woman. I come from the inner city, being very, with my own journey, going to a therapist, being around other therapists, and feeling like I was just a diagnosis, you know? Like, if we look at mental health altogether, we don't say that person is suffering from bipolar disorder. We say that person is bipolar. Or that person is borderline. And we have a bad habit of making that person's mental illness their identity. So for me, when I was in school, I was like, that just doesn't feel right to me. You mean, these are people. And we don't say that that person is cancer or that person is diabetes. We say that person is either suffering from diabetes, have diabetes, or has cancer, battling cancer. We don't say that for anything else but mental illness. So for me, when I went into private practice, my major thing was making sure I do affirming psychotherapy. If the only thing I do is make a safe place for people to come, I may not help you get rid of your depression. I may not help you get rid of your anxiety. But my number one motto is to make sure that the space is safe for someone to explore whatever it is they want to explore. So that's what I would say. That's what affirming psychotherapy means for me.
I love that, and thank you. And I think that is important anytime somebody's reaching out to anybody, whether it's therapist, counselor, whatever title you want to give it. You need that safe space and that unbiasedness to really be frank about things. And I will say, when it comes to sexuality, it can be very hard to talk to some therapists because, you know, it's either, I mean, you can read all the books you want, but I think, you know, having that open mind and maybe the background experience of yourself, you know, so you can relate, I think that's a huge thing. Going back to addictions, what are some signs, like, because I really don't know what are some of the signs of sex addiction, for instance, for men. Like, you know, my partner, he's younger, and, you know, he's mm-hmm. like, freaking little jackrabbit, a little energizer buzzy bunny. And it's like, okay, and he was asking me, so do you think I have a sex problem? And I was like, well, I don't know, no. I just think, you know, that's just no, I mean, who, so anyways, what is the technical or what have you learned is sex addictions or too much or whatever?
You know, this is, Michaela, you hit on something big. This is a heavy topic in the sex therapy community, whether sex can be considered an addiction. I mean, we have been going back and forth. Some that were pro-sex addiction diagnosis, now it's sexual urges, and we are just not on the same page, to be honest. We are not. For me, what I've learned is, like any other addiction, anything that is obsessive and compulsive, despite negative consequences, so that is legal issues, am I doing, engaging in this behavior, and I am, let's say for sex, I am going out, I am going to the street, I am paying for prostitutes, and I'm getting arrested because of that, and I feel like I'm out of control. It's out of control behavior that I just cannot stop. I have to do this. It is, what is a lot of sex? Well, that's up to the person. For one
right.
person, it can be, I just need once a week. For someone else, I may need it three times a day. But that person that's getting it three times a day or wanting it three times a day, are they a sex addict? No. You know, am I losing my job? Am I not doing my household chores? Am I spending all my money? It's out of control behavior. But I have to say, we are not on the same page when it comes to this quote-unquote definition of sex addiction. We are not. But a lot of people, I think, in my opinion, have used and thrown that word, that term around so much that anything, especially when it comes to partners and relationships, if I have a partner and they're watching porn and I feel like I'm not good enough, then I'm going to say that person must be a sex addict, because why would he or she want to watch porn and not want to engage with me? So they must be a sex addict. Or my partner wants me every single day, and I just don't want it every single day like they do. That partner must be a sex addict. So a lot of times we throw this term around, and it's really not sex addiction. It's not. It's just, baby, I want to fuck. I want you. I mean, I love you. I want you. I desire you. Why wouldn't I want you? You turn me on. Like, but we've thrown this terminology around so much that I think maybe that's the basis of debate, and that's just my opinion. I don't have any evidence to back it. I think that's my opinion.
Well, I appreciate that, because I think that was so huge and important. It's like, you're right, you know, it might just be that you and your partner on different levels of where – how frequent you want to have, you know, that interaction. And then that's another thing that you pointed out about the whole porn thing. I hear that commonly from people is, you know, that their man is watching porn and da-da-da-da-da. And I mean, I don't know. Like, I mean, I think you really addressed it really well. I don't think it could be – it is an addiction. I mean, it probably will cause them problems, though, if they are not – you know, if they're, it's less for you. But, I mean, I don't see the issue with a porn, you know, with that. Like, I mean, have you had couples come in complaining about issues with the porn stuff, and how do you work through that with some of them?
Oh, yes, a lot. We're both male, and we don't want to just make it just a male
issue.
It's men.
Okay.
Yeah, women too. And I think we're just not as open about it, but a lot of couples coming in and one partner or one or more partners, depending on the dynamic, may watch porn, may want their partners to watch porn with them, and the other partner doesn't like it or seems like it's unhealthy, maybe messages like, what's wrong with me? I'm not good enough. I can't do. I mean, because porn, I mean, it's sometimes some of the porn is not even reality. Like, so if you have a lot of times if porn with quote-unquote porn addiction, if I'm watching it and I'm getting this stimulation over and over, over and over and over and over again, and I have this expectation that my partner is supposed to do everything sexual that I've seen in this porn scene, and then I may find that I can't get aroused. I may find that I can't have an orgasm because my brain is so fixated on that porn scene or whatever I'm into. So a lot of couples come in and go, they used to desire me before, and then now they're into watching this type of porn or that type of porn, and then when we get together, they don't seem like they're into it. They don't seem like they're satisfied. I don't need porn in order to be stimulated. And there you go, there's a problem. Or one partner is spending an outrageous amount of money watching porn, buying subscriptions. They feel a lot of shame and guilt, so they may be doing it in privacy without their partner knowing, and then the partner feels lied to, they feel betrayed. So you have all these different issues that may come up when people come in for treatment.
Okay. You know, I was going to kind of save this question for last, but I'm going to jump ahead to it right now just because you're touching on this. And I think it's so important for people to have healthier and funner sex lives. And so what is some of the advice that you would say to people in order to have that with their partners or even just for themselves? I mean, what do you think are the key elements for that?
Oh, a healthier and funner sex life. Again, defining what's healthy. So when we talked about before, the frequency, duration, if it's more than one partner, is it living out my fantasies, my kink, my fetishes? I want to have sex in different places? Is it, you know, different things about what can enhance your sex life? I think the biggest thing for me is that person, one or more people, feeling good about their body, making sure that they like it, making sure that they are okay with their body, okay with how they look, okay with their partners touching their body. Number two, decreasing the amount of pity sex you have. We always go, oh, I'm so tired, but my partner wants to have sex, so I'm going to go ahead and have sex. Don't get me wrong. We don't want to just, you know, knock down your partner and say, no, I'm not having sex tonight. But we also don't want to have this repetitive cycle of I'm only having sex because my partner wants to have sex. So it's just finding out those kind of little things. Also noticing different changes. So if you start to have children, you know, you may have this healthy, thriving, fun sex life, and then children come into play. And then you have all these responsibilities now, or I'm working more hours at my job, or I have a medical illness that came up, so I may not get lubricated as much. Hormones may come into play. I'm sick, and I just don't feel like it. So I think a lot of times we have to just kind of adjust appropriately and make sure we look at the term healthy. What is healthy for one person may not be healthy for another. And communicate before, during, after sex. Have fun with it. Don't try to attempt. A lot of people go into it going, my only goal is to make this person come. I'm going to make this person have an orgasm. I'm going to make them come. And they miss out on just being together and connecting. So then you have all these other issues that may come up with, like performance anxiety. And then you went from having a healthy sex life to a non-existent sex life because now I feel like I can't perform. And, you know, achieving an orgasm, that is more future-oriented. And a lot of times we're so concerned about the future that we miss the present. We don't stay in the present. We don't think about, I am having sex with this person because I love them or I care for them and I want to share this experience with them. No, all we want to do is I'm going to make him and her come. I'm going to make them come hard, and that's it. And you miss the whole, whatever, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 45 minutes, whatever is your thing, you miss the whole thing. And I think that is a big issue when we talk about having a healthy, fun sex life.
Thank you, my dear. I appreciate that. I think that is, I agree with you, the whole communication part. And the other thing, too, is, you know, I think also, at least that I noticed, too, when I had my little ones, it was, you know, yes, time was gone. And, you know, there was, it ended up being that resentment and that frustration and that built up tension. And it's like, you know, I think people forget that just as important is to work on their relationship, their sex life. I mean, you know, we put all these other dates on the calendar and schedule all this other crap in, but we forget that each other is important in ourselves. So I think that's, you know, something else that people need to remind themselves to put as much effort into relationships and themselves as they would to anything else, you know. Aisha, we got about 10 minutes left, and so still enough time, but I just want to make sure we gauge where we're at. You know, one of the things that you also deal with is sexual trauma. And so how do you, would you help others, some of the things that you would do with others to help them move past that and love themselves or be able to be more open with their partners? Because I've never experienced sexual trauma, and goodness forbid the ones that have. I mean, how have you helped some of them work through that?
The biggest thing for me, like I said before, is making them feel safe. Feeling safe in my office. I reject stereotypes. I try to normalize their experiences and also take away that notion that they did something to cause that type of sexual trauma. So you may, if it's a person, it felt, well, because I dressed this way, this is the reason why I was raped. Or because I did this, or my body betrayed me. So I know I did not want it, but my penis got hard. I got wet, and my perpetrator said, you must like it because you did this. The human body is going to betray you, okay? Stimulation, you rub me right. The body doesn't know that, okay, well, this is not a person that's supposed to be touching me. So the body is just going to respond to that stimuli. So for me, it's like just creating that atmosphere of safety, and we talk about those different issues about our bodies. Other things is not wanting them to kind of move past it. Like who moves past it? We can deal with it. We can cope with it. It never happened. And I think that's the biggest thing. Like we talk about what happens in this house stays in this house. It happened. And what did it mean for you? Did it mean that you did anything wrong, that you deserved that? Absolutely not. Finding meaning to it, even if the meaning was this person took away this my power then, and right now they no longer have that power over me. So we work a lot on different, like, power dynamics. I don't really agree with having that person relive the trauma, so I do my trauma work comes from training from therapists that worked with, like, high-profile cases like Timothy McVeigh. So where it's almost like an association where you're not making that person relive the trauma, but actually kind of recreate that trauma in different ways. So I may do what I call, like, the remote control technique. So as we're talking about it, that person now has that power to stop, start, and pause where they were, to look at that younger version of themselves and say, you are safe. And if I could have protected you, this is what I would have did. And they start to feel empowered. I can't make them feel empowered. They, on their own, start feeling empowered. So it's a lot that goes into trauma work, but just like the gist of it, I would say going back, not to go off on a tangent, it's just making them feel safe, number one, finding meaning to what happened, and giving them techniques and coping skills and things of that nature to talk about it and talk about what happened and, you know, kind of plan for the future.
I like that, and thank you for clarifying, because I did put in my question, move past it, and, you know, so insensitive, you know, but again, I'm owning that, but at the same time, like, you know, it really came from a place of love, but there are some people we are ignorant, unfortunately, and if we haven't been there, it's like, well, brush it off, damn it, it happened 10 years ago, it happened 5 years ago, and it's like, right. Hey, are you in their shoes? So, yeah, I feel that, and yeah. I'm glad that pointed that out. So much more, dear, that we can cover. Quickly, though, yeah. I do want, there's two more things I want to cover, but one I wanted to ask is, I know this is not a show for children, but I know there's listeners out there that are parents, and we both have children of our own. And so my question to you is, what kind of advice would you give to parents when they're talking to their children about sex or sexuality in general? What would you want them to know or to pass on for our future generations?
I would say make it age appropriate for that individual. So what I may say to a 13-year-old, I'm not saying to a 5-year-old.
Okay.
Also, look at your own beliefs about sex and sexuality. So if you're nervous or you're anxious about talking about sex, if you have your own stereotypes and biases about sex, your children are going to pick up on that. Children are very smart, and a lot of times we don't give them credit. So if I'm anxious talking about sex, well, they may start feeling anxious of talking about sex, too. Also, get up with the times. Sometimes I talk to people and they have these old views and I don't get social media, but guess what? It's happening. People are posting pictures of themselves. We are more open about our bodies, but we are not sometimes up with the times as parents. So get up with the times. Do your research. Know the different terms and lingos out here. You can still keep your traditions and your morals and your values, but also go into the life of your kids. So if you have a teenager and they're on different social media platforms, talk to them about that. Talk to them about posting pictures. Talk to them about perpetrators who may use that as a way to exploit them. Revenge porn is a big one. Videotaping, camming, different things. And I would say make it very, very age-appropriate and watch out for your own biases and your own views about sex. And if you need guidance, seek guidance for a qualified professional.
I appreciate that, Ms. Aisha. Well, you know, got 3 minutes left, and I wanted to just say, is there anything else that you wanted to share with the listeners tonight before we go, or is there anything that you might want to promote as well?
I would just say, first of all, thank you, Michaela, for having me. Thank you for allowing me to share my views. For any of the listeners that need to connect with me in any way, you can visit my website by going to www.behowyou.com. That's www.behowyou.com. Number two, don't let your priorities be an excuse not to have a happy and healthy sex life. Seek guidance when necessary. Love each other. Live, laugh, and love. Seek help when needed. You are loved. You are valued in this world. I do have some things coming up in 2018, a new sexual wellness line that I will be promoting later on. It will be on my website later on this year. But, again, thank you, Michaela, so much for having me. I've had fun tonight, and I think I talked a lot. I need some water now.
We definitely needed more time, and I definitely will be trying to finagle you on for another show for sure. And, definitely keep the listeners posted as you go on your journey helping them with this, with sexuality. I think it's important, and I just appreciate you taking that time because I felt the love. I think our listeners definitely got some insight in here tonight, and it's very real, so I appreciate that, and I support all your endeavors, my dear.
Thank you.
Have a good night, listeners. Thank you so much for listening. You take care. Have a great week. Big, big hugs. I'll catch you next week.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah.